This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
8 waves across the United States.
And currently the banks have spectacular loss on a size that's unprecedented.
Our country could go into depression greater than the Great Depression.
This week on Radio EcoShock, the losing game. 1 in 7 Americans are now officially poor. Millions are losing their homes. Some are sleeping in their cars. The recovery was just a fantasy. If we all believed hard enough, the empty shell economy could stumble on forever. Now even the mainstream media doubts our chances. I'm Alex Smith. There are people who know. What are they saying? You will hear three voices on the Triple Crunch: climate chaos, energy decline, and a global Ponzi economy going bust. Stoneley will warn you.
It's actually very difficult, I find, to talk to people and to get them to understand just how removed from reality their current lives really are and how far they have to fall, and that they should be doing something about that right now.
Lawrence Budd explains life after peak water.
We try to explain to them that it's not the money, it's the water. I will hand you more money if it makes you happy, but I can't hand you more water.
And we chat with musician and gardener Dana Pearson about getting out.
It all just vaporized. It's all a facade anyway, right? The value of something, it's all a game.
And getting trapped when the world is running down. There are signs already of extreme climate stress, and even government authorities quietly admit the world is using up fossil fuels that power everything. The best-laid plans call for huge spending to transition to clean energy and adaptation to a warmer world, but how can we pay for it if our financial system is already weak or breaking down? Our next guest writes as Stoneley for one of the most popular financial blogs called The Automatic Earth. She has returned from a speaking tour in Europe and North America. Stoneley, it's a pleasure to have you on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much, Alex. It's a pleasure to be here.
In your recording that I heard from Europe, you described your own progress through climate change and then exploring peak oil and then into finance, looking for what will hit us soonest. Can you tell us about that?
Well, I'm a big picture person on the whole. It's not quite a linear progression, really, from one to the next. I was a biologist to start with, so it wasn't merely climate change. It was pollution of all kinds and carrying capacity and population and all manner of biological issues. Then I carried that through into energy to a large extent. I got interested in finance primarily between about 15 and 20 years ago and really decided this was something that I wanted to develop a lot more facility with, because it seemed to me that if you follow the money, you follow the power, and I wanted to understand how the world worked. And what I've been trying to do ever since is really to put all that together, whether it's climate or energy or realpolitik or human psychology or all manner of environmental work and finance and legal relationships and power games, and all manner of things. It just seems to me the important thing is to make complexity comprehensible. Too many people focus on one single part and ignore the context. I really think you need to look at all of it, but in such a way that it can be understood.
And I suppose that's what you do with your blog. But, you know, it seems to me that we're approaching this stress point in the economy that a lot of people are very worried about on a personal level and on a social level. How would you characterize our economic situation?
Oh, dire. But most people don't realize anything like how dire. Essentially, we had a long period of rally. We had a rally that lasted about a year until the end of April. And a rally brings with it a resurgence of confidence, a sense that it's all going to be all right, green shoots of recovery, optimism again. And we're still living with that at this point. Although the markets have turned again, I don't think reality has caught up with that. People haven't realized that the trend is down again. So people really are still living in this bubble world, and they're not realizing what is coming, and what's coming reasonably soon, I would argue. I think certainly within the next couple of years, we're going to see a tremendous amount of upheaval and people having the rug pulled out from under their feet. Really, all the assumptions they've built their lives on are going to be just proven to be false over the next couple of years, I think.
I suppose that's a learning experience, but it's one we're all trying to put off. I mean, things are very good right now. The supermarkets are full of food from all over the world. Many of us are living all right, those of us who are still employed, at least. So extend and pretend, they call it. Is that going to keep working?
No, I would argue not for very much longer at all. And more people are falling off the back of the truck, so to speak. And the news gets written by the people who are still on the truck. But the number of people who are falling by the wayside is expanding dramatically quickly as unemployment rises and people simply lose access to purchasing power of almost any kind. So you're seeing a lot of people on food stamps, a lot of people running out of unemployment benefits and simply ceasing to be counted. And right now they don't have a voice, but when there are enough of them, they will. And I think we're moving very strongly towards that period where you reach a critical mass of people who've fallen off the back of the truck.
It's true, you know, they don't even seem to appear very much. They're not in television or movies or all the successful places. And so I think that's part of the role that many of us would like to play, is to be able to bring that out, that there's a new population forming. And many of those are young. I really worry about the young people. They're coming out, in some places 50% of those kids are not going to get jobs in the things they've been trained for in colleges. They're going to be angry when they can't have all the things that their parents had, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. And that's going to be a tremendously powerful dynamic going forward, that the baby boomer generation and Gen Xers to some extent as well are essentially sitting on all the money. And the prospects for young people are just absolutely dreadful. Not only are they not likely to get jobs in what they're trained for, they'll be lucky to get any jobs at all. There simply are so few opportunities, I think, that are going to be developing for people in that position. And unfortunately, a lot of them are also enormously indebted. And it's not like they even have an asset they could sell to pay off that debt. They are simply in a state of debt slavery. And what they've worked for is not necessarily going to achieve anything for them, but the debt is still very real. And I think the consequences of that could be considerable. I feel really, really sorry for the young generation, and I think they're going to be incredibly angry with the generation of their parents and grandparents who have had control of more wealth than any generation on the face of the earth, and are expecting to now live a very long and comfortable retirement, perhaps. It's simply not going to happen. There's not going to be anyone to support it in terms of not enough money to support it, but also very much not the mood to support it either, when young people are going to have to be living with so much less.
So true. Well, this bubble seems to be worldwide, but it pops in different places in different times. We know about America starting in 2007, really, and the financial stress in Mediterranean countries like Greece and Spain. But here in Canada, where I live, and in Australia, property prices are still high and unemployment doesn't seem so bad. It seems like things are going all right.
The west coast of Canada is one of the largest property bubbles in the whole world. There's a very interesting post called Crack Shack or Mansion, looking at a whole series of million-dollar properties in Vancouver and asking you to guess which it is. And it's very, very difficult to guess, as it happens. The property prices in Vancouver are staggeringly high, and it's all held up by cheap credit. It's going to have one of the largest falls anywhere. It just hasn't happened yet. You're quite right that bubbles burst at different times in different places. When I was touring Ireland very recently, people were coming up to me and saying, but my house is already only worth 40% of what I owe on it, and I only bought it 2 years ago. And so they're so much further along the line of the bubble bursting, and we haven't even really seen anything. We saw a small wobble before the rally. There was about 6 months where things were looking difficult, and Stephen Harper even occasionally used the word depression. But the rally came along, everyone went back to sleep again. And in Canada, it's actually very difficult, I find, to talk to people and to get them to understand just how removed from reality their current lives really are and how far they have to fall, and that they should be doing something about that right now. It is tremendously difficult, whereas in other places where things are already getting more difficult, people are much more receptive to the message, and they understand to some extent where we're going and are very interested to know what they can do about it. In Canada, people just tend to think, well, no, I don't think so. It couldn't possibly be that bad, and they don't do anything much at all.
And ditto Australia. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is blog writer and speaker Stoneleigh from The Automatic Earth. Well, then you've sort of led into my next question, which is, what are you advising people to do when you're doing your speaking tours?
Essentially, people need to hold no debt, hold cash and cash equivalents, gain some control over the essentials of their own existence, and be prepared to work with other people to a much larger extent than people have done in the past, or in the recent past anyway. Really, any efforts you can put into working with community, you're leveraging your own efforts. People need to rebuild local self-sufficiency over whatever essentials of their own existence they can. And that's much better done at a community level than an individual level. What we have done is outsource the production of so many things that we now have these very long and vulnerable supply chains for almost everything. We need to break down that system and go for a lot more bottom-up local production of all manner of things, so that when trade breaks down, as trade does in a depression, we will not end up simply without the things that we rely on. So people have a tremendous range of activities that they can engage in. Getting out of debt is enormous. It really is. And making sure you have some money, because the value of money will go up as the value of all manner of other things, asset prices and consumer goods. As those values fall, the value of money will go up. But interest rates will be high enough, certainly in real terms, that debt will be just a millstone around people's necks. They have to get out from under debt. They have to hold a certain amount of cash, and they must work with other people. They'll get a lot further down the list of things they need to do if they pool resources and work with others.
You know, when I read on the net and try and follow the news, it seems to me that governments are, many of them, bankrupt, really, if they had to admit to their debts. The U.S. owes so many trillions. And not just national governments, but state governments in California and New Jersey and elsewhere are close to bankruptcy, and some city governments are already proposing bankruptcy. The banks are technically bankrupt, but they're hiding massive losses. And you've got all these corporations saddled with debt from this binge of mergers and acquisitions. And the pension funds are frightened and underfunded. So somebody has to have the money. Where did all the money go?
Well, there essentially is no money. Money is willed into thin air. When you borrow money, that creates a money supply. Paying off that debt or defaulting on it, that money is simply gone. So we don't simply have some people sitting on all the money and other people sitting on all the debt. We simply have a mountain of debt. And you're quite right. With all those institutions and corporate structures as well that are all indebted, and it's people as well. People are tremendously indebted. And that level of debt simply becomes an unbelievable burden on an economy. This is why credit expansions are essentially Ponzi schemes, because what they do is they create excess claims to underlying real wealth. And whenever you have an enormous number of excess claims created to underlying real wealth, those claims are going to be extinguished. So the debt will not be repaid, but people will be engaging in a real wealth grab, trying to make sure they get their hands on whatever aspects of real wealth they still can. This is how deflation plays out, and deflation is very much what we're facing. But this mountain of debt is absolutely unpayable. There is bankruptcy around the corner for a huge number of governments and corporations and individuals. That's absolutely true.
Is that what happened in the Great Depression?
Oh, yes. An enormous number of banks failed, and government finances were in a terrible state. Trade collapsed. A lot of people became bankrupt. Yes, absolutely. We're going to see that same kind of dynamic again, where you get the excess claims to underlying real wealth extinguished, prices absolutely plummet, and you have a period of economic seizure, because money is like the oil in the engine of your car. It's the lubricant. And if you try and drive your car with the oil light on because there's not enough lubricant in that engine, it is going to seize up. If you try and run an economy without a large enough money supply, it will seize up as well. 95%+ of the money supply is credit. Credit is excess claims to underlying real wealth. That is what will disappear in a deflation. So we're looking at tremendous crash of the money supply, and then people who still have money are going to be hanging on to it because they don't know when they're going to earn any more. So they're going to be hoarding what they have, which reduces the velocity of money, by which I mean even less money is moving around in the economy. So that just strengthens the potential for an economic seizure. That is what happened in the 30s, and that is very much what we're facing again today. You won't be able to connect buyers and sellers because there won't be money in the system in anything like sufficient quantities.
I hear you say this, and at the same time, I have this longing for more mass transit systems and more renewable energy systems, and those are very expensive items. And so without money for change, do you think it's possible we'll remain kind of frozen in time, trying to carry on while things slowly fall apart with no money to fix them? Is that what we're looking at?
I think they might fall apart rapidly, actually, but essentially, I mean, so some things fall apart slowly. Infrastructure certainly takes a certain amount of time to decay, but I don't see these things being built because, for exactly the reason you mentioned, that they're very expensive, and we simply aren't going to have the money. And this is tragic as far as I'm concerned, because I'm a great fan of these things myself. I would love to see mass transit and renewable power and a decent amount of grid investment that would go along with renewable power that would actually make it feasible, and all manner of other initiatives that would be much more localized, much more responsive to local populations. I would very much like to see that, but there is so much investment required, and quite frankly, the money isn't going to be there. So the odds of any of these large projects actually being realized are very, very low. I think the kind of adaptation that we're likely to see is simply going without and then making do with what in whatever way we can with the infrastructure we currently have, but with very, very little money to use it in the way that we currently do. So, for instance, instead of mass transit, I think people are actually going to be walking and cycling and things a lot more than simply maintaining the status quo where they drive everywhere. Because if you can't afford to buy gas and you can't afford to maintain your vehicle, then you won't be driving it for very much longer. And if mass transit isn't an option, then your options are cycling and walking. So I think it's going to be a very painful period of adjustment.
But, you know, cycling and walking is what we saw in China just 20 years ago. That's how people can function in this way to some degree. Well, when we look at this debacle, I guess we'd have to say this real possibility of collapse unfolding before us, one question that many of us are going to ask is this based on fraud at the top? I mean, we know that the stock markets are being manipulated by robot traders and by gigantic banks. Or is it really a question of mass delusion where we all went along with it and thought we could just use a credit card to buy everything we ever wanted? So how do you put things in that scale?
I think it's a predator-prey system, and you have both. You have predators and you have prey. It is a mass delusion. I don't see it as being a fraud purely directed from the top down, from the center. It would not work if you did not have the buy-in of the mass population. And really, I don't see governments and central bankers having anything like the power they think they do anyway. I think they're a bit like the Wizard of Oz, that they look very powerful, but they're actually the little man behind the curtain. And where the power really lies is the power of the collective, the power of the bond market, the power of an enormous range of short-term self-interested decisions being made, and that the aggregate of those decisions determining where we go. And if everyone decides to make the same decisions at the same time, then you have, say, a cascade in the stock market that will simply overrun anything that governments and central banks attempt to do about it. That power of the collective, I think, is really where the power lies. So I don't see a sort of small elite fraud to simply take over everything. I think that's too conspiracy-minded. I think it really is simply a predator-prey system. I think it always has been. It simply is not recently become that way. There is a huge amount of fraud in the system, of course, but I don't see that being something that confers control on the system. I think it's merely ways to exploit one's own personal circumstances for short-term personal gain if one happens to be a member of the elite and therefore has that kind of freedom of action.
It's difficult to hear this in a way, and I think it's difficult for our listeners to hear this. So we have to think also about our psychological approach to this. How are we going to get past our own personal depression and money worries and anxiety? A lot of people just push it away. They don't want to think about it. But let's say we do. We realize this is happening. How do you handle it?
Essentially, I think it's very important to have a sense of purpose. And just because we can't save the world and we can't necessarily go out and build all our wonderful renewable energy systems and mass transit systems the way we would ideally want, we can't let the perfect be the enemy of the good, or at least the best possible under the circumstances. There's a lot that can be done, and I think we need to simply say, well, we can't have the best world that we wanted. What can we have, and what do we have to do to get there? So being able to work with other people, build local self-sufficiency, these things are very worthwhile goals. And there is nothing that is a better antidote for depression than a tremendous sense of purpose. That really is what people need. The greater the extent to which they're prepared to take responsibility for their own lives and their own communities, you take that responsibility onto their own shoulders and do what they can in a public-spirited frame of mind, the less the likelihood they will simply fall into some kind of depression. The kind of people for whom the consumer lifestyle is everything, and that really defines their happiness, they are going to be extremely unhappy people. I think people need to leave that behind and say, what can we build, what can we do, and let's just get up and do it right now. And people will be surprised how invigorating that can actually be. If they're prepared to say, well, the whole consumer lifestyle was unsustainable anyway, that was not going to continue no matter what we did, so we simply have to get over that and move on and build what we can, I think that is tremendously empowering. And that's one of the things I'm really trying to do with going around and talking to people, to say, don't lie down in the face of difficulties, but take it one step at a time, do what you can do, and to the largest extent possible, do it with other people, because that is the way to have this situation that we're facing have the minimum possible impact. And the psychological impact is huge. If you can minimize the psychological impact, then you keep people in a more constructive frame of mind, and that is absolutely critical.
For those who want to follow up, can you give our listeners a description of your blog and how they can find it?
Well, we're theautomaticearth.blogspot.com, and we're a big picture website, so we're looking primarily at the moment at energy and finance, because those two things have the shortest time frame. It's not the other things aren't important. We really are looking at a wide range of challenges, but we need to take it one step at a time, so we need to know what's coming first. Finance is coming first, and then energy. We have to deal with those in order to maintain the freedom of action to address the other things later. So we have to rescue money, for instance, from the grip of the system in order to have the freedom of action to address the energy crisis that is coming, and down the line, climate crises and other environmental crises. And that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to provide a roadmap, a timeline, what you have to do when, what kind of actions are coming up, what kind of warning signs are out there, and what are those warning signs telling people? So what do they have to do, how they have to do it, and what they need to be aware of? That's very much what we see as our role. And I travel around all over the world at the moment trying to turn virtual communities into real ones as part of a kind of outreach, if you like, for the website. I'm trying to bring people together, because we have a very large virtual community at the Automatic Earth, but that won't matter much when push comes to shove. When times are hard, you need a real community. So I'm going around to talk to people to bring them together and try and convey the sense of urgency that they need to do something about this while they still can.
people. You've been listening to the very strong voice of Stone Lay, speaker and author on the blog The Automatic Earth at blogspot.com. I've been reading it almost daily for the past 2 years, and I have to say, it can be an island of sanity in that sea of propaganda that passes for financial reporting these days, and it's more than finance. It's our lives. It's highly recommended. Thank you, Stone Lay, so much for sharing your time with us today.
You're very welcome, Alex.
You're listening to Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
How bad do you think it is? A new survey from Strategy One finds 2 out of 3 Americans expect another recession. 44% of those people think the worst is yet to come. Only 5% of those polled really expected a recovery this year. Real average earnings went up only 6% in this decade. But consumer spending increased 54%. How did that happen? Retail chains flourished to serve this mass delusion, powered by the big piggy banks in the real estate market. AFP Newswire has finally reported on all those people living in their cars in Ventura, California. Radio EcoShock covered all that in our show for May 2, 2008, 2 years ago. Download our pocket advice for living in your car if you had to. State and city governments teeter on the edge of bankruptcy. The state of Pennsylvania just stepped in to hold off foreclosure on its capital, Harrisburg. Some places cut public buses, others close schools Friday. Street lights go dim. Police officers get pink slips, along with teachers and even ambulance drivers. Many of the bankrupt cities spent billions on major capital projects that enriched the bankers and developers. Now they cannot even cover the interest. It all sounds so familiar from the bad old days of development in South America and Africa. Arianna Huffington writes, America is in danger of becoming a third world country. There's a race for who can be the most bleak in establishment mouthpieces like the New York Times. An alarming number of Americans are just one paycheck away from abject poverty, no savings. Others don't even get that paycheck. In the New York Times, future writer Douglas Copeland has a new word for us, blank-collar workers, former middle-class workers who will never be middle-class again and who will never come to terms with that. They are blank-collar workers. Fortune, say the wise Chinese, is a wheel. It rises and falls for everything that lives. In fallen times is the greatest opportunity. Did we need those foreclosed monster houses? Did we need all those cops rigged out for terrorism in tiny Midwest towns? Did we need the financial mill houses? What do we need? My friends, we are about to find that out. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. I have Lawrence Budd on the phone with me. He's got a long history in water conservation and different water techniques that we could hear about, especially in the western part of the United States. And so, Lawrence, could you tell us just a little bit about your background?
Oh, sure. I actually began irrigating crops in high school southwest of Denver down by Red Rocks, and one thing led to another. I began doing irrigation systems in college in the 70s in Colorado, and that morphed into doing drip systems in New Mexico in the 90s. Nowadays, having done hundreds or thousands of irrigation and drip systems, I now mostly consult. I'm a certified water auditor and an EPA WaterSense partner in irrigation. I work across the country with cities and private corporations to control their outdoor water use and bring it down to where it should be.
Well, there's three things I'm hoping we're going to talk about a little today, and that is the drying of the West, about water conservation, as you say, and then perhaps at the end, the way that people may be thinking of migrating towards places where there will be water and a more dependable climate with climate change rolling along. Now, when we start with cities, we think that the West may be drying out. There are signs from the satellites that the crops are getting browner, that the trees are getting browner, that the whole landscape is changing, and we see it in our lowering water reservoirs. Is that your sense as well?
It is. That is my sense, although bear in mind I've only been alive for 50 or so years to watch this personally. I know that the Earth goes through cycles, and I know that we have cold and wet cycles, and we have hot and dry cycles. While I do believe firmly in global warming and our effect on the atmosphere, I also acknowledge that what we're doing may be tying into a natural cycle, as many of the weather experts are saying now. The people at NCAR, for example, are saying that they think that we are heading into a 50 or 100-year hot and dry cycle in the Southwest. So when you take that situation of lower snowpack and diminishing water tables, and you add that with a quickly growing population in some areas, that's a very bad combination. So I think we are in trouble there.
How are cities reacting to that?
Some cities are reacting quickly and strongly, and others are barely reacting at all. I have the unique position that I have worked with about 10 or 15 different cities in the Southwest directly, and I've noticed a trend in that the smaller the city, the better they are to react and respond. The larger the city or the water entity, the more that politics get in the way and the much slower they are to respond. And no offense to Los Angeles, but the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, they are doing things now, but it took us about 3 years of constant badgering to get them going.
And you say that some ethnic groups within those cities handle water better than others.
Yes, that's something that only a handful of us, like myself, have noticed, because I do a lot of classes and outreach and home visits in the Los Angeles region, for example, and other regions. I've noticed that the Hispanics and the Orientals tend to have a much greater realization of the value of water, and when you say to them, we need you to use less water, they're ready to comply immediately because they grew up in situations where there was very little clean, safe water. In sharp contrast, the average Americans living in the western cities, especially in the sand cities, we cling to that notion that we must transform the desert into Kentucky or North Germany, and we just see a persistence of people wanting to take an acre of desert and make it into Ireland. And when I go and speak to them and say, you know, can you please help us and not use so much water, they get very angry and they point out that they're Americans and they earned their money the hard way and it's their right to spend it on water. And we try to explain to them that it's not the money, it's the water. I will hand you more money if it makes you happy, but I can't hand you more water. We have a very hard time with the upper-income American group.
And in my retreat area, there are people who are living in a near-desert area that are just filling it with lawns and lawns and more lawns. It seems like a kind of American plague or maybe an international plague. Talk to us about the impact of lawns on this whole situation.
Well, it's funny you mention that, because in Canada, you know, I know that a lot of your immigrants are coming from Britain and such, and I know that, you know, when you're in Britain, you've got a green lawn automatically. You don't have to do anything. Just snap your fingers and you've got a green lawn. And so I guess they come to the arid west of Canada and they just, you know, they figure, well, we've got to have a green lawn here too. The impact of lawns, as Timothy Brick was the outgoing head of the water district for all of Southern California, the MWD, and he's told me personally on several occasions that he would like to remove all of the grass in Southern California. And I certainly understand where he's coming from. I can almost agree with him. I think having a little bit of green is a wonderful thing, and I'm not for taking it all out. But the sad fact is that in the American Southwest, and not just California, I'm talking about everything from East Texas all the way through to San Francisco, we tend to overwater our lawns horribly. The grass only needs X amount of water per week, and in hot weather that might be an inch and a half, but typically when I walk onto a commercial site or a large residential site and I look at the controller, it's set to run 3 or 4 inches per week, often 16 inches per month, which is far more water than the turf ever needs. So something that your listeners can do and you can do with your neighbors at your new place in Canada is walk out with them with a stopwatch and turn a zone on, and then start your stopwatch and time how many minutes it takes before the water starts leaving the lawn and running down the street. And then you stop the stopwatch and you say, we just found out how long this zone can run before you start wasting water. And I can tell you from experience, that time span is usually 2 to 3 minutes.
I've heard, too, that in Las Vegas, they are paying people to take out lawns.
Yes, it's the Cash for Grass program. It's had some success, some initial success in Las Vegas, and then it kind of cooled down. I know the director of that program. We used to work together 20 years ago. He told me he has millions of dollars to hand out for this program, and he told me that they had some initial response, and it kind of slowed down. He's up to $2 per square foot is what he'll give people to take out grass. And I think there's an upper limit of something like $5,000 max. What people find is that, and what I find as a landscaper, is that taking out grass costs a dollar or more a square foot. It can. And then putting in a xeriscape, a nice xeriscape with plants and ground cover and all that, and converting your spray system to a good drip system, that can cost $5 or $6 per square foot. We're finding that people figure that out and they kind of go, well, you know, I'm going to get $5,000, but it's going to cost me $10,000 to do it. And they kind of have second thoughts. Quite a few cities across the West have adopted this program with a lot of fanfare at the startup. But then what I've noticed is they kind of quickly die down.
You've said that there has actually been a reduction in water use, but not for the reason that we expected.
Yes, that's been quite an interesting saga over the last couple of years. 2 or 3 years ago, a lot of Western cities got revved up, and they said, we're going to reduce our water use, we're going to become more efficient, and we're going to institute a program, like Los Angeles. You may have heard this program in California that Governor Schwarzenegger announced called 20 by 2020, and the program was designed to reduce water use by 20% by the year 2020, next 10 years. The idea was to reduce about 3-4% water per year. And so they went off with the best of intentions, and many cities said to themselves, we can afford to lose 3% of our sales per year and not affect our revenue stream. Well, so what happened was over the last 2 years, so many cities had so many foreclosures that cities across the country, even cities that don't have conservation programs, saw a 15% or more drop in water consumption. And they all showed up at the annual meeting this last spring and said, this is really interesting. We had this huge drop in water use and we don't know why. Well, it's the foreclosures. So the prime example of this is Las Vegas, which had dropped 25% in their water use the last 2 years. And initially they announced that this was due to their conservation measures. And then they realized, I think, that a lot of it was the fact they have a 20% drop in single-family home residents. So in other words, they've got 20% fewer landscapes being watered.
So when people get foreclosed, of course, they take off and the lawn doesn't get watered. It gets browned out and it gets used a lot less and all the appliances inside the house are not using water and so on. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, and we're talking with Lawrence Budd. I'd like to think about, too, this idea that running out of water in the West or in any part of the world, coupled with hotter temperatures, may cause people to migrate. We've noticed that there are people from all over the world are coming to British Columbia, and especially the coastal city where I live in Vancouver. Have you seen even anecdotal evidence that people are starting to think about moving towards more survivable locations?
Yes, definitely. Of course, I'm often involved in water conservation conversations, and this comes up a lot with my peer group, maybe because we see the writing on the wall and we know what the trends are and what's happening. People talk a lot about the fact that Central Canada is going to become even more of the wheat basket for North America, and that the southwest part of America is going to, at some point, is going to have to start going down in population if the water supply keeps vanishing. In my personal peer group and friends and family and such, I know 5 people who have recently bought properties up around Vancouver and Seattle in an effort to get back to an area that will have water and be a safe place to be. There is definitely an awareness of this. And I find it fascinating. I also hear my friends from Britain talking more and more about emigrating to Canada.
Which is interesting because Britain itself is projected to remain quite livable because it is surrounded by a cooling ocean. James Lovelock, the famous climate scientist, has suggested the British should be busy building new hospitals and schools to accommodate all the people from North Africa and the Mediterranean region who are going to be burned out and come north. Do you see other countries may have to deal with climate immigration in the decades and or perhaps century to come?
I do. I should say that I think that my friends from Britain who are looking and moving to Canada are doing so not so much because of climate as opposed to quality of life. I think they're concerned that Britain is going to be overrun with refugees. Scandinavia is very worried right now that they're going to be overrun with refugees. There have been newspaper articles just in the last couple of weeks out of France and Germany and Scandinavia saying, when do we close the door? Do we close, you know, what's going to happen to us if we just keep getting wave after wave of people fleeing hot Africa and the hot Middle East? And, you know, it's both monetary and climate. It's not just climate. So there's a huge concern right now in the EU about this.
And Japan could be another refuge place, although it has had closed doors to most immigration for a long time. And then we have Russian Siberia. I have to think that historically, maybe it'll be a century from now or two centuries from now, a large number of people from China will want to move north just because that's where the water is and that's where the growing temperatures are. It's pretty hard for us to tell at this point. Getting back to some of your knowledge of solutions, what are a couple of the technologies we should avoid perhaps when it comes to making more water, and what are some of the technologies that we could use?
Well, I'm a big proponent of rain catchment if you're in a part of the world that has rain. And briefly about that, I'll say that there's such a craze right now about installing rain catchment systems, and I have some friends who are working very hard to set those up on a large scale in San Diego. It hardly ever rains in San Diego. They're proposing 50,000-gallon subterranean cisterns and parking lots, which is great, and indeed we can fill one of those in one good rainstorm off of a Walmart or a Kmart roof, but it doesn't rain much. Whereas in the central part of the U.S. and the eastern part of the U.S., it makes a lot more sense. There's a lot more payback doing that. So I'm all for rain catchment if it's raining. I'm concerned about the current construction right now in Southern California of desalination plants. Everyone's very excited. They're convinced it's going to solve all their problems. But the people building those plants tell us that that water could go for as much as $25 per 1,000-gallon unit, whereas right now people pay between $2 and $4 per unit. So this is going to eliminate a lot of poorer people from using that water. It's going to be very costly to produce. And it also, desal plants have the tendency to dump highly salted water back into the nearby ocean, which is bad for the local marine life. Over the last couple of years in Los Angeles, a couple of us have been sounding the alarm that as the water prices go up in Los Angeles, a lot of lower-income people, seniors, and renters have completely stopped watering their landscapes in order to save money. A recent survey of 6,000 people showed the main reason they save water is to save money, not to save the water. But as a result, we're seeing trees dying around Los Angeles. I saw a lot of this in Pasadena, in those old neighborhoods that have big 80-foot trees. A lot of them are getting very stressed, and the homeowners don't think about it, especially if they're seniors. They're thinking, we can't afford to water the lawn. Let's shut it off. The lawn turns brown, big deal. But they don't stop and think that we have two big trees shading our house, and by killing them, we're going to greatly increase our cooling costs.
And you had some suggestions for people in the Caribbean.
I do. It's a new idea we've been working on. The Caribbean is short of drinking water, always has been. They're desert islands. Kind of a funny combination when you think about it, but it's true. And we're working now, some people that I work with, we're working right now on the concept of installing bigger and better rain catchment systems to serve entire towns and villages. Believe it or not, I think that the Caribbean will be a relatively easy fix.
As we wrap up, do you have some resources or places that you'd like to point us towards?
Yeah, I do. As a matter of fact, there's a number of them, obviously. you can always call and ask me questions. And if I'm around and have time, I'll be happy to answer them. And I'm at urbanwaterconservation.com. People ask me every day about rain catchment and rain ponds and drip systems, for especially for crops. And there's a real good company out of Willits, California called DripWorks. And their website is dripworks.com. Very good company, been around for a long time, and very knowledgeable and very helpful, and very good prices.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. We have been talking with Lawrence Budd, and I really want to thank you, Lawrence, for sharing all your water knowledge with us.
Oh, thank you. My pleasure.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Americans are stuck. At the turn of the 21st century, in 2000, 16% of Americans moved to a different place, 43 million people. Going for a new job or relationship or just to start again, it's the American way. With all the roads in the world, Americans are a mobile people. All that is changing, and I think this is an underreported story of the times. In the good old days, which was just 3 or 4 years ago, you sold your home and you went wherever. Now millions of Americans are stuck. They can't sell because they are underwater, owing the bank more than their home is worth, or because the going price seems ridiculously low. Nobody can get a loan to buy it, and who wants to buy a liability like real estate these days anyway? That means an end to many dreams, less social mobility, better marry close to home, no chance to get out and find work elsewhere. I'm not sure the American economy can withstand the uncharted impacts of frozen people in frozen real estate. Now, reporters sometimes drain their friends for a story. I volunteered musician and master gardener Dana Pearson to stand in. We had a casual conversation over Skype while he was in his back garden, and what a garden it is. Dana is brave enough to let it go on air. I want you to hear this because there is a subtext for all those planning to escape from dangerous or degraded cities or wanting to have a place where you can grow your own food. You may dream of that organic farm in Canada where the climate will still be kind to your descendants. But is that door already closed? Let me get a little bit of picture here. How much space is your garden taking up? I mean, do you have an eighth of an acre, a quarter acre?
Probably an eighth.
An acre, probably, eh?
But we've got a ton of stuff packed in here. I mean, we got, you know, we got so many things. I've got fruit trees planted right next to each other, and we do a lot of interplanting. You know, like right there, there's an apple, there's a pear, there's a bunch of raspberries, plus a lot of ornamentals, you know, and like right back here, you know, we've got the pear, but then we got other stuff underneath it.
Right.
So I do a lot. I do high density type planting.
So are you also working? Are you going to other people's gardens, or what are you doing?
That's what we do. We do landscape, gardenscapes, artscapes, I guess. I mean, we made more money when there was more money because people wanted very artistic things, and we're pretty creative. And a small team, me, Nancy, and one other person. So now I'm doing a lot of edibles. You know, we're trying to integrate perennials with edibles. A lot more fruit trees, a lot more usable landscapes, shall we say. Trying to forestall the chaos in Oakland. Things like at our school, we just put in about 20 fruit trees. My daughter's elementary school and a native garden there. Now I don't have to go out and work as much because everybody's scared and nobody's buying, you know.
Hmm.
But we have a lot of maintenance, well, about 12, 13 maintenance, high, you know, quality maintenance accounts of gardens that we've done. Makes me enough to sort of keep my head up above water.
Right. So you were hoping to sell your place, but the real estate debacle has held you in place. Is that the story?
We had our immigration papers in for Canada.
Wow.
And we went up, and Margo and George, they had this great, it's about a 20-acre farm. They grew sprouts, plus huge greenhouse, wood-fired greenhouse, but totally 360 days a year. They serviced Nelson and two other towns around there with organic greens year-round. So we spent a couple weeks up there. I was in the greenhouse all night long with my podcast. I was listening to your stuff, too. I used their connection. I was downloading all your old shows, and I would just go in there and work all night long in the greenhouse, cleaning out the algae and or whatever, and you know, planting new beds and stuff. And it was like, okay, I found where I want to be, you know. And so we came back and started fixing up the house, and things started going down the hill. And we had one offer, which was a real nice offer in retrospect, but still wasn't enough to buy the farm. And going, no, we can do better because we know what sold next door, and it's a piece of junk. And that was probably a mistake. And so at that point, we weren't able to pull out our equity. It all just vaporized. It's all a facade anyway, right? The value of something.
Yes.
It's all a game.
Well, we're still in that game here very much in Vancouver, the highest values in the country, and it's just nuts. The most run-down old crack house, if it's within the city limits of Vancouver, is worth $1 million.
Sell and rent. Sell? Well, I'll tell you. You know it, dude.
I know.
All over. I mean, I was reading stuff today. It was like, we're headed for big, bad times. Well, if we are, eventually you are, right?
I think so. There's some differences. One thing is we still have a healthcare system which is working, and it would have been nice if you could have got up here and gotten part of that.
It would have been, because it's this cool little town. It was a couple, maybe a thousand people. I don't know. Salmo.
Oh, yeah. It's a great area. Nelson area is good people there.
Yeah, good people. Oh, I just loved it. And I would have been, yeah, we would have been up there. My daughter would have been in a little elementary school we went into, and I'd be farming right now, still writing and playing, and they're very frustrated because they built a house in the back, and we got off, and they were, you know, we were going to share the property, split it, and they would help teach us all the ropes, and as it is, they haven't been able to sell because things have leveled off, and their kids sort of took it over, and they're bored with it, and so it's sort of like this, you know. And now Canada's pretty much shut the borders. They've said, man, unless you got a lot of money, you ain't getting in there.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, because you could get in with a trade, you know, visa, you know, if you've got the skills and if you've got enough money. So we would have been able to, it looked pretty good before, but now it's gotten a lot harder, you know.
Wow.
I would say, though, boy, I mean, if you're still high value, sell and rent. And so at least you have the money in the bank.
I guess so. But, you know, we can't even it would cost us a lot more to rent than we're paying on our little mortgage. I mean, we really underbought. We knew that things were going to get very tough. And they gave us this obscene amount of money to play with, you know, supposedly, and said, well, make sure you buy as high as you can because values can only go up. And I went, oh, bullshit to that, you know. So we bought actually one of the cheapest properties in the whole area, but it has lots of room, and we really like the place.
Well, as long as you've got a sanctuary someplace.
We do, and we're very close to having this paid off. So I don't know. It's fairly cheap to operate from that point. But we may have to, as I may have told you, get out of the city and go to this little town where we have our mobile home right now.
Yeah, that's what I keep saying to Nancy. Somehow we got to put together a group of people and at least get something someplace for the kids.
But you're better off than most of the people around you, surely, with all the food that you're growing.
Yeah. However, one has to wonder what would happen if things go south terribly to our, you know, it's not like we're in the middle of nowhere. That's like, no, we're in the middle of everywhere. And, you know, just down the road, you know, we can hear the gunshots every night. So our little sanctuary is merely a second away from who want it.
You know, I saw a feature on NBC News last night of a woman who was living in quite a large house, and she'd been out of work for 3 years. And their story was how so many people were dipping into their 401ks.
Of course.
And she was doing that and taking out big penalties to pay the taxes on this place. And then it showed her sort of walking down the street and with her two dogs behind it. I could see that she was probably our age or a little bit younger, but definitely quite overweight, out of shape, trying to save a house that was huge. Her kids had already moved out. So just no adaptation, no signs of adapting, just hanging on until you go right over the waterfall.
Right. Well, there are people in the Bay Area. I think we're luckier than a lot. But still, the masses, I would think, are in that boat. They have no concept. And I mean, my daughter does because she goes out with us, plays in the gardens. And, you know, she understands life and nature. But and that's what we're trying to get into the school system. However, at times you just go, impossible, you know, the inertia, the breadth of people, the lack of, yeah. And the question for me is, do I want to be in the middle of a city where there's already challenges that would just get worse? I would really enjoy being up there.
Well, I hope you make it. I hope I make it. I'm in the middle of a city right here with no way to feed myself. That makes me nervous.
Love the city, though, I must say. We spent some time up there.
It is nice. I was just downtown. They closed off the main street, and there were a lot of musicians and artists sort of filling up. You know, you could walk down the street, no cars. They built a lot of new bike lanes in there. And I did see community gardens springing up, you know, from the SkyTrain as we moved along. There's some hope, but still, this is a port city, and we have a gigantic granary down at the port that is usually full of portion of the wheat going to China. So I suppose if very hard times struck, people would raid the granary, or maybe some local government would distribute food from it or something. It's hard to tell how this is going to go. It seems so surreal. I mean, we were just up in the mall, and everybody was shopping for fun, as far as I could tell.
At the same time, I really track all the solar developments and everything, and there's so many awesome things coming around. And it's like, that's what we should be focusing on. We should be talking about it. It should be a whole excited, energized program reinventing ourselves. That's what we need to be doing right now, is reinventing ourselves so that we can continue to have fun. I mean, we all do enjoy having fun, and everybody else wants to have fun, and they haven't been able to have fun yet, right? I guess that's the hard part for me, is watching this not.
Well, I heard what you just said, though. I mean, if I just concentrate on, we're all screwed, we would be missing quite a bit. I could see somebody doing a demo of a solar unit or a new solar house. And I do try and do a bit on that. We did some things on the passive house and so on.
That's my startup page is all positive solar stuff. So I don't get too depressed. Although my partner, Nancy, says, you just are constantly bumming me out.
Well, I'm afraid I'm doing that for my partner. I tend to be a magnet for the bad news and ruminating on it, you know.
I do know. Thank you for letting me know that I'm truly not alone. Although I know I'm not, because I listen to enough people talking about it. But.
I want to thank Dana for sharing his story. You will hear more from our listeners as this season goes on. And you will see more as well. Radio EcoShock is developing a YouTube channel with selected video interviews recorded with a new tool called VodBurner. Capturing Skype video calls becomes the new TV. More people now watch YouTube than conventional television. Radio EcoShock will be there. Watch this space.
Path unknown.
Path unknown?
That's my name, as Google gave it.
We also have a large audience of downloaders from our website at ecoshock.org and from other podcast feeders and readers. Last June, we had over 31,000 Radio EcoShock programs downloaded in a single month. Hello to all those around the world who volunteer to be disturbed with the awful truth and maybe one of the most depressing shows on radio. Well, I try. And thank you for listening.